Good afternoon, and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know. You can find us online at commonwealthclub.org, on Facebook and Twitter, and on your YouTube channel. I am Ladaris Hazard Cordell. I'm a retired judge, and I'm currently the independent police auditor for the city of San Jose. And I am your moderator for today's program. Advocate, author, philanthropist, political commentator, and celebrated broadcaster, Tavis Smiley's in-depth documentaries and inspirational work with the next generation of leaders has created already an impressive legacy. His path to success from humble beginnings is a testament to his tremendous talent and motivational presence. For Tavis, growing up in Indiana, Dr. Martin Luther King's dedication to civil rights was a great source of inspiration. As a teenager, he memorized many of King's speeches, which helped him develop his amazing oratory skills and gave him tremendous stage presence. Dr. King died in one of the most shocking assassinations in U.S. history, but to the end, he remained committed to ending racial and economic inequality in our country. In his most recent book, Tavis has chronicled the final 365 days of Dr. King's life in Death of a King, the real story of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s final year. Tavis has run for public office, he's won numerous awards, and has made the most of every opportunity that has come his way. Please join me in giving a warm welcome to Tavis Smiley.
Thank you. Great to be back in San Francisco. Great to be back at the Commonwealth Club. This is my second or third time, George Cordell. That might very well be the second best introduction I've ever received. I say second best only because I was in Atlanta the other day and the person to introduce me didn't show up and I did it myself. So. Other than that, it was awfully nice, and I want to thank you. There's one particular person that I do want to acknowledge. I've been saying his name on this tour all across the country, and he's an American treasure, and there is no way that the book I'll talk about for the next 15 minutes or so, there's no way that this book could have been written without the heavy lifting that Dr. King's three principal biographers have done. They've done the righteous work in letting America know about the life and legacy of the person that I regard and dedicate this book to, America's greatest democratic, small d, America's greatest democratic public intellectual. And so one of the first phone calls that I made was to this particular person to ask him his advice and counsel and give him some sense what I was attempting to do. And it's kind of hard when one of your heroes becomes your friend. When one of your heroes becomes your friend, it's kind of hard to kind of process and situate that. But King, as I said earlier, has three principal biographers. They are Taylor Branch, of course, with his series, his trilogy, America in the King Years, David Garrell, of course, with Bearing the Cross, and Claiborne Carson, who Mrs. King, Coretta Scott King, personally decided should be in charge of the King Papers Project. And there is no way that this book, Death of a King, could have been written without the immense contributions of these three brilliant writers, these three grand contributors, to letters about the life and legacy of Dr. King. And I was just almost went into full cardiac arrest when I sat in my seat and looked out and saw him staring me in my face. It's intimidating but also humbling to have in this audience today as I talk about Dr. King, one of his three principal biographers, my dear friend. Please welcome Professor Claiborne Carson. Humbled to have him in this room today. Let me say a brief word about the text in a few minutes here, and then I'm going to sit and we'll engage in some dialogue. I think part of what's wrong with our country today on so many different fronts is that we are too often engaged in monologue but not enough in dialogue. And so I'm always interested to listen and to learn from your questions and your comments. And again, in the Bay Area, a whole lot of smart people. So I'm always looking to learn something when I come this way. I can't say that about everywhere I go, but in the Bay Area. Sometimes I'm the smartest person in the room, and that's a real problem. If I'm the smartest Negro in the room. But in the barrier, there's always something to listen and learn from. So I look forward to our dialogue today. But in the 15 minutes they've asked me to say a few words about the text, let me just start at the beginning, as it were, the beginning of how I, and Judge Cordell kind of intimated this a moment ago. Since I was a 12-year-old kid, I have had Dr. King as a part of my DNA. Let me tell the story very quickly. I've written about this in one of my previous texts called What I Know for Sure, my memoir, What I Know for Sure, my story of growing up in America. In that book, you'll read the story in detail of how at the age of 12, I was accused of doing something. My sister and I, I'm one of 10 kids. There are 10 of us, 8 boys and 2 girls. My sister Phyllis and I were accused of doing something in our church that we had not done. I, quite frankly, didn't know we'd been accused of doing anything. And so we'd been accused of doing something in the church that we had not done or not guilty of. And unbeknownst to me, in front of the entire congregation, the pastor of the church stands up and chastises my sister and me in front of the entire church organization. I'm a 12-year-old kid. Chastises us pretty aggressively in front of the entire church gathering. My parents, of course, who were very involved in the church, my father's on the deacon board, my mother's on the board of trustees, my mother and father are both Sunday school teachers. A major, major embarrassment. For those who've been around a while, you know that back in the day, the only place a black man felt any stature was in the black church. And so it was the most humiliating, degrading thing that could ever happen. Embarrassing for my sister and myself to be called out, as it were, in front of the entire congregation. Now, keep in mind, we'd never been called into the pastor's study. There was no conversation. There was no communication whatsoever. We just got outed in front of the whole church. And we were looking at each other like, what is he talking about? And so my father, in a moment of rare rage, I had never seen him behave this way before. He has never behaved this way since. But on this particular night, for all the wrong reasons, my father completely lost his temper. And when we got home, my sister and I were beaten so severely, we were in the hospital for 2 weeks. 2 weeks in the hospital, she and I both were in traction for 2 weeks. And I'm a 12-year-old kid, and I can't make sense of any of this. I can't understand why this has happened. Why were we blamed for something that we didn't do? Why were we not called in for a congregation, for a conversation rather, when we got home? Why did my father not sit down and ask us what happened? There was absolutely no conversation. We were kids to be talked to but not listened to be chastised but not communicated with. And so it turns out that that was the beating of my life. I've been asked many times on this book tour over the last couple of weeks about Adrian Peterson, and it's hard to talk about that Adrian Peterson situation because I have lived that, the worst of it. Adrian didn't beat his kid because he hated his kid. My father didn't beat me because he hated me. I never felt a day in my life that my father didn't love me. Indeed, that day I didn't feel like my father hated me. I knew my father had lost it that particular day, and there's nothing I could really do about it. It took us a lot of years to get beyond that and to make peace with that moment. But for the time being, as a 12-year-old kid in the hospital in traction, I hated my father for doing what he did. I hated my mother for being in the house while he was beating me and not protecting me, not stepping in to stop him. So I hated both of my parents. I hated the pastor vehemently hated the pastor of the church that I'd been going to since I was born. I hated him. I hated everybody. I was just filled with rage and hatred, but mostly I couldn't understand why this had happened. I'm a pretty analytical person, and I can handle anything as long as I can process it and understand it. I just couldn't make sense of this. It just made no sense at all. And it's the defining moment of my life. There's no doubt about this. So a deacon in my church, another deacon, my father was a deacon, as I said, a deacon in my church came to visit me, and brought me a gift. And the gift was a box. And in the box were a number of LPs of King recordings. Turns out that Berry Gordy of Motown fame, who I just literally taped a TV show with yesterday, Motown 25, that moment where Michael did the moonwalk across the stage, and that Motown 25 is now out on DVD. And Berry Gordy came by the TV set yesterday to pre-tape a conversation about the DVD. So I saw Mr. Gordy yesterday and thanked him once again, as I always do, for having the good sense to send an engineer around to follow Dr. King to record much of what Dr. King was saying. I think many of us believe, nobody in this room because I'm in San Francisco, but in those other places I go where people are not as enlightened, I think many Americans believe that Dr. King only gave one speech in his whole life. And they think that speech only had one line in it. Shall we say it together? That I want my children to live in a nation where they'll not be judged by the color of their skin, but by the... Except for Claiborne Carson, I ain't going to ask you to go no farther. because I know that's all you know, is that one line. That's the narrative we've been given for all these years. The king gave one speech. The speech only had one line in it, and that's all we basically know of Dr. King. I was in Memphis the other day, honored to speak at the National Civil Rights Museum, where, of course, Dr. King was assassinated on that balcony at the Lorraine Motel. C-SPAN came to cover that for the nation. That was the stop on the tour they wanted to come to for all the obvious reasons. And I said to the Memphians that night, I caught myself. I said, most of us think King only gave one speech in his life. And I said, oh, shoot, I'm in Memphis. So y'all know he gave at least two speeches. Y'all got that joke, right? Mountaintop, the night before he died, was in Memphis. Okay. So the Memphians knew he gave at least two speeches. But this deacon came to me, and thanks to Barry Gordy, who had been had an engineer following Dr. King around, there were many other speeches that Gordy recorded, and later he put some of this stuff out on LP. This deacon had collected these LPs, and for whatever reason, I don't know why to this day, except that God must have put it on his heart, he came to visit me and brought me this box. And I tell you, I remember like it was yesterday, and if I stay on it too long, I'll start crying, so we're going to move real fast. But I remember like it was yesterday, getting a chance for the first time to hear Dr. King's voice on those LPs, and the love in his heart and the hope in his soul was so reassuring for me. King was talking to a nation about the power of love, about how love is the most powerful force in the world, the only thing that can turn an enemy into a friend. He's talking to a country, but he might as well have been talking to a 12-year-old kid named Tavis, because what King was saying to me was, Tavis, you are going to have to find a way to love your way through this situation. You got to love your way out of it. You got to forgive your way out of it. I heard King saying to a nation, but he might as well have been saying to me, it's not about the power, it's not about the love of power, but rather the power of love. That love is the most transformative thing in the world. And if you don't love your way out of this, you're going to be a very embittered person for the rest of your life. Some things happen and we just can't understand why they happen, but we have to appeal to that better part of ourselves and find a way to love our way through the madness. My sister didn't have the benefit of those King tapes, and so my life went this way thanks to Dr. King, and her life went the other way. And when we got out of the hospital, she never came back to live with us. We were taken out of my parents' family. We go to court. My father's arrested, all the stuff you can imagine, in this little small town of Indiana. So Phyllis went on to become a crack addict, have babies out of wedlock. It just completely wrecked and ruined her life because her spirit was broken. And all these years later, while she's doing better, she still has never fully recuperated from her spirit being broken. And my spirit was broken that day as well. But thank God Dr. King came to me in the way that he did. Because he had long since been dead at that point, but he really brought me back to life. He literally and figuratively saved my life. And since I was 12, all I've ever wanted to do in the world is one thing, which is to do my small part, my very small part, to make the world safe for the legacy of Dr. King. That's my goal in life. When you see me on television or radio or writing books or wherever you might see me, my goal is always the same, to do my small part, to make the world safe for the legacy of Dr. King. What is that legacy, Tavis? Glad you asked. Justice for all, service to others, and a love that liberates people. Justice for all, service to others, and a love that liberates people. And so since I was 12, I've been a student of King, and everything I could get my hands on that was written about him or said about him or that he wrote or that he uttered, my basement, you would think I was a stalker. If King came to my house, he would think I was a stalker. Claiborne Carson has good reason to be surrounded by King material. I just was just enthralled with the guy. That my basement in my house to this day is everything that I've ever collected about Dr. King. So from the age of 12, you can imagine every chance I've had to talk to people who were with him and around him and worked with him and loved him and part of his family. I mean, everybody who's anybody who's been in that circle, I've wanted to talk to. And so when I got a chance to, you know, when Claiborne Carson was chosen to do this, I sought him out and became his friend. But everybody in that space I've wanted to spend time with. And so fortunately, for the last 25 years or so as a broadcaster, I've had the good fortune of talking to just about everybody at some point who was in that particular space. And I've been keeping copious notes all these years. I could have written this book some years ago, and I did not for a lot of reasons. But the reason why the book is being written now, and I think timing is everything, the reason why the book is being written now is because I believe that Dr. King has been so sanitized and so sterilized, so beatified in some ways, that we don't really know who Martin Luther King Jr. really was. I believe that we come to know who we are in the darkest and most difficult days of our lives. Anybody agree with that? That when everything is going well, it's all good, as we say. But in the dark and difficult moments, we come to know who we really are. So if you don't know who King was in the darkest and most difficult days of his life, with respect, you really don't know him. You got to see him in that dark and difficult moment. And that happens to be for him. It was never easy, but that happens to be for him, I believe, the last year of his life. So for me, my favorite Martin is not the Martin of Montgomery, not the Martin of I Have a Dream, not the Martin of Selma, not the Martin of Birmingham, not even the Martin of the Voting Rights or Civil Rights Act, and not even the Martin of the Nobel Peace Prize. My favorite Martin is the one who in that last year of his life, from April 4, 67 to April 4, 68, when everything and everybody turns against him, this brother still stands in his truth every day and keeps telling the truth against all the odds until they take him out. Let's talk very quickly in 5 minutes about that last year. April 4, 67, King goes to Riverside Church in Manhattan and gives the most controversial talk of his life called Beyond Vietnam. In that speech, he calls America the greatest purveyor of violence in the world today. That is a damning indictment. The greatest purveyor of violence in the world today. Now, this is Dr. King, Nobel laureate, but he's still a Negro. This is still the 60s. He's already been called a communist. At the height of the war, he is now telling America, you are the greatest purveyor of violence in the world today. Said it with courage, conviction, and commitment, but said it. You are the greatest purveyor of violence in the world today. He said, I come to this house tonight because my conscience leaves me no other choice. Sometimes, King said, silence is betrayal. Sometimes silence is betrayal. So he calls America out as the greatest purveyor of violence in the world. And then he goes on in that speech to talk about the triple threat of racism and poverty and militarism. King basically says, we are just going to lose our democracy if we don't get serious about tackling the triple threat of racism, poverty, and militarism. For giving that speech, I'm moving through this very quickly to get to your Q&A. For giving that speech, the next day, everything and everybody turned on Dr. King. Everything. Everybody turned on him. Martin had to feel like the cosmos had shifted against him. When I say everything and everybody, I mean the media turned on him quicker than right now and sooner than at once. The very next day, every major paper in this country, there was no Fox News back then. We can imagine what they would have done to him. There was no Fox News, but I'm talking now, forget the conservatives, I'm talking about the liberal press. When you read in this book, Death of a King, what the New York Times said about him, it's going to embarrass you. But the liberal Washington Post, what about him? It's going to hurt your feelings. I mean, you read what Time Magazine said about him, it's going to make you cry. The liberal press turned on him with a vengeance the very next day. Negro, we have given you license to talk about civil rights, but foreign policy ain't none of your business. You're out of your lane. You don't talk about foreign policy. Martin was saying that budgets are moral documents. We're squandering money there that ought to be spent here at home. You don't tell us how to prioritize federal budget spending. That ain't your business. Martin was saying that war is the enemy of the poor. The bombs that you're dropping in Vietnam are landing in the ghettos and barrios of American cities. That ain't none of your business, Martin. Stay, Negro, in your lane. We have not given you license to move out of this lane. And so the press wrote that he had outlived his usefulness to his people. They said his speech sounded like a commercial for Radio Hanoi. They say that he will never be taken seriously again. Read in this text what the liberal press said about Dr. King. So the media turned on him the very next morning with a vengeance. And after the media turns on him, then the White House turns on him. Lyndon Johnson and King had worked together, as you know, for Voting Rights and Civil Rights Act. But now Martin and Lyndon Johnson are going head to head. I've been telling this joke as I go around the country for all the black folk who've been mad at me for the last 7 years for being too tough on Barack Obama, for hating on Barack Obama, for trying to hold Barack Obama accountable. Negroes, I've become persona non grata in many respects in black America for the last 7 years. Y'all Negroes owe me an apology. Because when you read this book and you see what Dr. King said to Lyndon Johnson, what he said to Lyndon Johnson, what he told Lyndon Johnson, the telegrams he sent to Lyndon Johnson, I ain't got nowhere near critiquing Obama in the way that Dr. King critiqued Lyndon Johnson. Dr. King always did it in love. I believe, as King believed, that there's nothing that you ever have to say to another human being that you can't find a way to say in love. So King says it in love, but he did not hold his tongue with Lyndon Johnson. he critiqued him severely on this question of war. He said to Lyndon Johnson, you called for a war on poverty, but now you engage on a war in Vietnam. How do you juxtapose those two things? Martin was against violence here, against violence there, against violence everywhere. You heard him say it many times, injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere. So Martin was at least consistent. But the media didn't want to hear that. The White House didn't want to hear that. So they turned on him. And then white America turned on him. Get this. The last poll taken in his life, the Harris poll, found that nearly 3/4 of the American people, I think that means 75%, of the American people thought he was irrelevant. Hard to juxtapose that reality with the way we have deified him in death. We've so deified Martin in death, we don't want to accept that we demonized him in life. In many ways, then, what are you saying, Tavis? We helped to kill Dr. King. We helped to kill him because we abandoned him, because we couldn't handle the subversiveness of the truth that he was trying to tell us about racism and poverty and militarism. So the media turns on him, and then the White House turns on him, and then white America turns on him. 75% think he is irrelevant, but hold on to your hat. In black America, almost 60% of black people thought he was irrelevant and persona non grata. Almost 60% of us. If that ain't bad enough, then Roy Wilkins and the NAACP come after Dr. King publicly. If that's not bad enough, then Whitney Young of the Urban League come after him publicly. If that's not bad enough, Ralph Bunche, the only other black Nobel laureate, Ralph Bunche was on the board of directors for the NAACP. The organization passed a resolution to condemn Dr. King. When Ralph Bunche saw it, it wasn't tough enough. He made it even uglier. He put some more language into the resolution. Ralph Bunche, the only other black Nobel laureate, comes out against King publicly. And then Adam Caton Powell Jr., hater, straight hater. When you read in this book what Powell did to Dr. King in his face one night at dinner, wait till you read what Adam Clayton Powell did to Dr. King. And I can't even quote on this TV camera right now. I can't even quote for you what Thurgood Marshall, yes, that Thurgood Marshall, you'll see it in the text. When you read what Thurgood Marshall said about Dr. King, you're going to be flabbergasted. Everybody turns on him. The bourgeois elite Negroes are mad at him because they don't like him getting into it with Lyndon Johnson, because you're going to mess it up for all of us, Martin. You talk about foreign policy. We got work to do here on the domestic agenda. Shut up, Negro. So the bourgeois elite turn on him. And the everyday Negro, especially the young ones, for him, even though Martin's only 38, for them, he's out of step and out of touch, because black power is coming on. They want to hear Stokely Carmichael and H. Rap Brown and Huey P. Newton. They don't want to hear Martin in this nonviolence notion. They want black power. Martin says black power is a great slogan, but it ain't no strategy. So everybody, black, white, media, body politic, everybody turns on Martin. Then Dr. Carson knows all too well, inside of his own team, he called his own team, these are his words, he called his own team at SCLC a team of wild horses. That's his phrase, a team of wild horses, because he can't get them to support him on the Vietnam question. His own organization passed a resolution to condemn him. His board of directors condemned him for his position on the war in Vietnam. I told my staff the other day, I said, if y'all Negroes ever think at the Smiley Group, ain't going to be no insurrection up in here. You're not going to pass no resolution condemning me for nothing, not in my operation. But Martin's own team passed a resolution to condemn him. And then as he's trying to engage the Poor People's Campaign, they didn't want none of that either. So he couldn't get his own team to work with him. And on top of all that, he's feeling the death angel hovering in his space. He knows there's a bullet out there with his name on it. The death threats are coming every single day. There are paid informants inside of his own camp. His treasurer, James Harrison, is an FBI informant paid. And the photographer is an FBI informant paid. So they're calling in reports every single day of what's happening on the inside. He's catching hell on the inside, catching hell on the outside. Who does Martin King turn to in the last year of his life? Who is he really? How does he navigate all the hell and hate coming at him every single day? And why is it that we don't know this story about the last mile of the way that Dr. King had to walk? You know why we don't know it? Because they don't want us to know this part of the story, because that messes with our image of King as a dreamer with that smile on his face and "we shall overcome" and "kumbaya" and, you know, "free at last" and the monument and the postage stamp and the holiday and the schools and the libraries and the streets. That messes up our narrative. And so we can't handle that. We've frozen Martin in 63 without I Have a Dream speech. The Negro lived 5 years longer. Still died too young, but 5 years later. He's evolving on a lot of things over 5 years. He's evolving. The king in 67, the last year of his life, says the dream he had in 63, these are his words, has now become a nightmare. The I Have a Dream man says to Harry Belafonte and others that for all that we've done for integration, I fear that we have integrated, says Martin, into a burning house. That's Martin King. And hold on to your seat because this one's going to mess you up. King is killed on a Thursday night in Memphis. Had he made it back to Atlanta on that Sunday, as he did every Sunday, wherever he was, he got back home on Sunday for his church at Ebenezer. Had he made it back to Atlanta that Sunday, the sermon that he was going to preach come Sunday morning was entitled, Why America May Go to Hell. When you tell folks that I Have a Dream man was going to preach a sermon called Why America May Go to Hell, they can't handle that. Too subversive. He didn't say we were going to hell. He said we may go to hell. His thesis, if we don't get serious about the racism, poverty, and militarism that's facing this country, we're going to lose our democracy. And America's going to slide and sink into the abyss. We may go to hell. Now imagine this. Now, this is a year of catching hell and hate every day. Everything, everybody turns on him. And this Negro is still so committed to telling the truth that on Sunday, a year later, he's still going to stand up and preach a sermon called Why America May Go to Hell. Martin's a bad man. He's a bad man. I mean, he stands in his truth. No matter how inconvenient, how unsettling, or how unhousing, he stands in his truth. Get this. At one point in his life, this is near the end now, J. Edgar Hoover and the FBI declared Martin King the most dangerous man in America. I'll say that again. Think about this. Martin Luther King Jr., declared by J. Edgar Hoover and the FBI as the most dangerous man in all of America. Now ask yourself, how is it you can be the most dangerous person in all of America and the only weapon that you're using is love? Think about that. I mean, not just now, beyond today. Think about that. The most dangerous man in America and your only weapon is love. I think that says something to us today about the power of love, about how pregnant with power this notion of love is. We could have a whole conversation at another time. Maybe I'll come back someday and we'll talk about whatever happened to the notion of love in our public discourse. That's a whole seminar right there at Berkeley. Professor Nasir, whatever happened to the notion of love in our public discourse? Martin put love in the public square. Gandhi put love in the public square. Bobby Kennedy put love in the public square when he goes to Appalachia. Now we got, you say love now, you get laughed out the room. And all I mean by love is simply this, that everybody is worthy just because. All life is precious and equal in value just because. Everybody's somebody's child, everybody's somebody's kid. It's not about how many degrees you have, where you went to school, what kind of car you drive, what neighborhood you live in, how much money you make, how many titles you have, who your mom and them are, what kind of access you have. All life is equally precious and valuable. Love means that we're all worthy just because. And that was Martin's philosophy. That's Kingian to the core, that we're all worthy just because. And so Martin didn't make these kinds of distinctions. Justice for all, service to others, and a love that liberates people. So I hope this book will allow us to see King for who he really was in a more complete and complex picture. I call it a historical novel. As I take my seat, I call it a historical novel because it's written just like that. Everything in it is historic, and you'll see all the data, all the research notes in the back of the text to let you know where I got the data from. You'll see Claiborne Carson's name. So you'll see all the research material that we use and resources for the book. So it's all accurate. It's all historical. But I call it a historical novel because I want to do something different, not just focus on the last year, which we do. Nobody's done that before. But to write a book basically from Martin's perspective, that is to say, we put you in the scene with Martin. And the book is written in real time from April 4, 67 to that bullet hits him in the head, April 4, 68. You're with him every step of the way for the last 12 months of his life. What he feels and endures, you go through that with him. He's never called Dr. King in the book. To you, he's Doc. He's Doc to his friends and colleagues, and to you, the reader, he's Doc. I want to humanize him for you and put you in his space so you can walk this last mile of the way with him. Finally, I hope this book will be a cautionary tale to those of us who are alive right now. Why? Because there are truth tellers right now in our society who, against all the odds, trying to get us to deal with some unconventional, unhousing, unsettling truths that we don't want to hear about. Our society pays a huge price every time we ignore the truth tellers. When you ignore the truth tellers, you eventually pay a heavy price for that. There are folk right now trying to tell the truth about what we're doing to the environment, and we don't want to hear it. About poverty threatening our very democracy, we don't want to hear it. About a drone program on steroids, we don't want to hear it. When we ignore our truth tellers, there is a heavy price to pay for that. And Martin Luther King Jr. is Exhibit A. Hope you enjoyed Death of a King. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Tavis. You're all here because you admire Tavis Smiley, Dr. King. This book is amazing, and I encourage all of you, to get a copy and to read it. Tavis, when I began just reading the book, I knew how it was going to end, mm-hmm. right? We all know what the ending is.
Yeah, yes. Spoiler alert, he dies in the end.
Yes. But, you know, as I read it, still I became more and more anxious as you wrote about everything that Dr. King was experiencing during this last year of his life, much of which I was unaware. Mm-hmm. So somehow you were able to get inside his head and then convey to the reader what all of this was like for him. So if you could talk to us just for a moment about the writing process.
Sure.
I mean, you've authored, counting this book, I think it's a total of 15 books, something
17.
Like that?
17, but who's
17
counting?
Books.
Yeah, yeah.
But this one's different.
Yeah.
It's different from the memoir. So how did you approach the writing, and when did you find the time to do it?
Yeah. The time, I don't know. I don't know how I found the time. But, you know, it's a passion project. I was turning 50 a couple of weeks ago. September 13th, to be exact. I still take gifts if you want to send them to me. So I turned 50 a couple weeks ago, and I knew that a year ago that I wanted this book out on the occasion of my 50th birthday. And it ties into what I said at the beginning. For me, this is my love letter to Dr. King. And I wouldn't have made it to 50 had King not saved my life at 12. So I knew that now was the right time for me to write this book as my, again, love letter to him. In terms of the writing process, David Ritz is my collaborator on this because David is such a wonderful narrative. He's such a wonderful writer. David Ritz is the person, he's the go-to guy for all the great artists. Marvin Gaye, Divided Soul, Marvin chose David Ritz. Ray Charles, Brother Ray, which the movie was based upon. Ray Charles chose David Ritz. Aretha Franklin chose David Ritz. B.B. King chose David Ritz. Willie Nelson is working with David Ritz right now. Buddy Guy, Etta James, the list goes on and on and on of all the great artist that David Ritz has written, because he's such a colorful writer. And I wanted this to be, as I said, a historical novel that gives you a different kind of... I'm not a Claiborne Carson. I'm not a historian. I'm not Taylor Branch. I ain't David Garrow. I am not a historian, not even trying to act like one. I wanted to write a book that everyday people could devour and move through very swiftly and very easily and make it a page-turner to get to know Dr. King in that last year of his life. So the writing process was picking the right person that could help me put the texture and color to the kind of story that I knew I wanted to tell.
In your book, you write of Dr. King's depression, and you write about his brother also who suffered from depression, and yet he refused to go to therapy, to have any treatment. So comment about that, and also you have something interesting. He had a massage person, though, and it was something interesting about this massage person.
Yeah.
Okay?
When King was 12, as Dr. Carson knows, King was 12, he tried to commit suicide. He loved parades. His mom and daddy were leaving the house one day, and Martin wanted to go to, there was a parade in town that day. Martin wanted to go to the parade, and they told Martin that he couldn't go, to stay home with his baby brother, A.D., and with his grandmother. And Martin, in that moment, disobeyed his parents after they left, went to the parade, came back, his grandmother is dead. His little brother, A.D., has been sliding down the rail from upstairs to downstairs in the house. A.D. ends up kicking his grandmother, coming down the rail, and thinks he's killed her. Well, she is dead, but he thinks he's killed her for all the obvious reasons. He kicked her. He thinks he killed her. Turns out that she had a heart condition and she was, you know, at the edge of death anyway. So it wasn't the kick. She was ill. She was old. But it turns out that that Martin comes back home and his grandmother is dead. And Martin feels the kind of radical empathy. I'll come back to that in a second. The kind of radical empathy that's hard to imagine a 12-year-old would feel. Martin feels like he was responsible for his grandmother's death. Because if he had done what his parents told him and stayed home, he can't imagine how that would have happened. So he personally blames himself for his grandmother being dead. He goes up to the top of the house, the roof, and jumps off and tries to kill himself. Thankfully, he survived, obviously. But he had that sort of mania, to your point, that sort of mania, even as a 12-year-old kid. That mania stays with him. There's a book coming out next year that is going to be very controversial, I suspect. Dr. Carson knows about it. Written by a professor at Tufts, which is going to be the first psychological profile of Dr. King. And there'll be, I can hear all the conversation. How do you psychologically profile somebody who's been dead 50 years? You know, so he's talked to all the right people and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And that's his book, not mine. I'm trying to sell my own book. But I talked to him. I talked to this professor because I wanted to get a sense of what he was working on. And he's written a wonderful piece. He wrote a piece a few months ago in Psychology Today that gave a little bit of a precursor to what his book is going to be about some months back, maybe 8 months ago. Anyway, I talked to him. And researchers now know, which is a fascinating connection, researchers now know that people with mania, people who have that kind of depression and despondency, end up having a deeper and more radical empathy for others because of their mania. Does that make sense? Makes sense to me. Because of their own suffering, their own condition, they end up having a greater empathy for other people. And so one of the arguments he's going to make in the text is that King had this sort of radical empathy, in part, I mean, it was all about the love notion that he believed in, but it was in part about that mania that he had that made him access that notion of radical empathy at a much deeper level. So, you know, there was mania, there was depression. In the last years of his life, Dr. King was hospitalized any number of times, officially for exhaustion, and there's no doubt he was exhausted, but that mania, I think, is a real issue as well that we got to come to terms with. To your question finally about the massage therapist, there was Dr. King could not really, he didn't have, one of the things I feel sorry for Dr. King about, he didn't have a lot of time for self-reflection. He's on the move, he's on the move all the time. Not a lot of time for self-reflection. And so one of the places that he was most at peace was his face down on the massage table with the best masseuse in Atlanta, to your question, who happened to be blind. The guy never saw Dr. King, never saw him, knew who he was, could never see him. But he and Martin had a wonderful relationship in those moments of being on that massage table face down. And what he loved was that the guy was so good at what he did in terms of just trying to get him through these pains he was feeling from just the stress he was feeling. The autopsy on King found that although dead at 39, he had the insides of a 65-year-old man. So that stress and that pressure was wearing on him anyway. So he was already under a lot of pressure as it was. But being on that table face down with this blind masseuse was the best. And King said all the time, what he loved most about it beyond his technique was that it was just quiet. The masseuse was smart enough to know to keep his mouth shut. And the whole time, King just had that moment of peace and tranquility and just escapism. So I hope that's what you asked. Is that what you asked me about?
Absolutely. Okay. Yeah, absolutely. This is the Commonwealth Club of California program, and we're talking to TV and radio host Tavis Smiley, author of Death of a King, The Real Story of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s Final Year. I'm Judge Ladaris Cordell, your moderator, and you can hear the Commonwealth Club programs on the radio, catch up with us on Facebook and Twitter, and see program videos on your YouTube channel. All right, another question. If Dr. King were an advisor to President Obama, what would he advise, and you can take your pick on these things, what would he advise President Obama to do about, and I'll give you, take your choice, the Middle East, mm-hmm. immigration reform, gay rights, policing in America?
I think I can answer all with one broad response, which is to say that if King were here now, he would be continually talking about the same triple threat he was talking about when he died. And it covers all of this in one way, shape, or form. Racism, poverty, and militarism. King was always for expanding rights, never shrinking rights. Never shrinking, always expanding. But he'd be talking about racism, poverty, and militarism. Now, to the Obama question, which I figured might come up at some point in this conversation. If King were here during the Obama era, Judge Cordell, one, he would have campaigned for Barack Obama. And two, he would have voted for Barack Obama. And then three, after the celebration, he would have become his chief critic. Now, why do I say this? In the text, you'll read the story. The closest thing that King got to seeing a black president in his lifetime, the closest he got to that, was seeing the first mayor first black mayor of a major American city elected. That's the closest he got to president, first black mayor of a major city, Carl Stokes in Cleveland. So King went to Cleveland many times, but he met those prostitutes. He was in Cleveland campaigning for Carl Stokes. So he campaigned hard for Stokes, and Stokes ended up winning. Stokes is a tragic story you'll read in the text. Again, I don't want to spoil too much of the book for you. But the night that Carl Stokes won, he was at that same Sheraton where King stayed in Cleveland. That was where the victory party was going to be. And Carl Stokes, about to be mayor, results are coming in, goes down the hallway, say hello to Dr. King and to thank him for all the work he's done to campaign for him. And says to Carl and says to Dr. King, thank you for doing everything you've done. I couldn't have done this tonight without you, yada, yada, yada. Says to King, you know, please stay close, because if I get on the podium tonight and I win, I want to bring you on the podium with me to publicly acknowledge you and thank you. But I want you to stand on that podium with me. Dr. King is still waiting for that phone call. Carl Stokes won that night. And when he got on that podium, like everybody else, he had no interest in being anywhere near Dr. King. King was so disregarded in the last year of his life that nobody wanted to stand next to him. Carl Stokes is like, I won, and by the way, I lied. He never called him on the podium. Didn't even call him down to the room, nothing. King was crushed. At that point, he was used to people just, this is Dr. King. Now, Carl Stokes ain't got no holiday. No monument, no posters. There. But he didn't even want to stand next to Dr. King. So I don't know why he even told that lie to begin with. But just embarrassed to stand next to Dr. King. So King would have campaigned for Obama, voted for him, and then became his chief critic, just like he was with Carl Stokes. Became his critic after he supported him. Now, since you're mayor, what you going to do about poverty? So he was all over Carl Stokes when he got elected. So the same thing with Obama. So, you know, I've often wondered what that bust of Dr. King in the Oval Office must be whispering to President Obama late at night when he's making his war plan. Barack Obama, this is always, you know, difficult for people to hear, but it's the truth, and the truth will set you free, if nothing else. It'll make folks hate you, but it will set you free. Barack Obama has a drone program on steroids. He has killed more innocent women and children than George Bush did. And we say on the one hand we're fighting terrorism, but at the same time we're creating more terrorists. Because as we kill innocent women and children, what do you think these persons now are avowed to do? To strike back at the evil American empire. So every time we do this and we kill innocent women and children, we're creating more terrorists. As we say, we're trying to fight terrorism. I'm so tired of Barack Obama saying we're going to degrade and destroy ISIS. You're not going to destroy anything. Evil is in the world, and you're not ever going to destroy it. Let's hope we can degrade it. I'm all for that. But stop saying you're going to degrade and destroy. You're not going to destroy, Mr. President, with all due respect. That language is a bit hyperbolic right there. That's a bit too much. We're not going to destroy it. Goodness is in the world. Evil's in the world. But you're not going to destroy it. So he'd have a strong critique of Barack Obama and, writ large, the American empire on this increasing, this growing. I guess this is not just Barack Obama, for y'all think I'm just demonizing him. This growing military-industrial complex, which has been growing long before Obama got to the White House. But this military-industrial complex continues to grow. And Martin would have a serious, very serious critique of that. On poverty, it took Barack Obama six... That's militarism. Okay, so on poverty, Barack Obama, it took him 6 years as president. 6 years. This just happened in December. Y'all saw this. It took him 6 years to give a major address on poverty and income inequality. Now, he campaigned on it. But 6 years in office before you give a major address on policy, policy address on poverty and income inequality. And when he got there, he said the right thing. Income inequality, poverty, the defining issue of our time. Yeah, you're right about that, but did it take you 6 years to figure that out? You think Dr. King would have stayed silent for 6 years? I told you earlier, if you think I've been tough on Obama, read the book and see what King said to Lyndon Johnson. King was much tougher on Johnson than I've been on Obama. And he would have given Obama the business on this poverty issue. He would not have sat quiet for 6 years waiting for the president to say something about poverty. And on race, Lord help us. I understand the constraints the president has on all these fronts. He's had a headwind of obstructionism since day one. I'm very sensitive to that. But on the issue of race, Ferguson, for him, was an epic fail. He missed a major moment, an epic fail. He was advised not to go there so you don't polarize. This ain't about polarizing. Man, you're the president of the United States. You have an American city on fire. You have an American city that's being militarized, and you are afraid to speak out. You're afraid to show up. My greatest fear for Obama 7 years ago is starting to be realized. I didn't want him to end up being a garden variety politician. I wanted him to be a statesman. I didn't want him to just be a transactional president. I want him to be a transformational president. And I think most of us who supported and voted for him, while we understand the headwind of obstructionism, a lot of us are just starting to feel like it just hasn't measured up. This is just not exactly what we thought it was going to be. And so I've said many times that great presidents aren't born, and Martin would agree with this. Great presidents aren't born, great presidents are made. They have to be pushed into their greatness. There is no Abraham Lincoln without Frederick Douglass pushing him. There is no FDR without A. Philip Randolph pushing him, and a woman named Eleanor pushing him. And there is no LBJ without MLK pushing him. You're not born, they're made. They got to be pushed into their greatness. And so Martin wouldn't have a problem with pushing Barack Obama, trying to help him become the best president he could become. Now, you know, in this era, it's hard to forget to get black folk in particular to understand that. So when Obama's out of office, I've said this many times, and it's true, and people don't want to hear it. When Barack Obama is out of office, the data has already made it abundantly clear. It's going to get worse before it gets better. The data is abundantly clear. Black people have lost ground in every single leading economic category during the Obama years. That's not all his fault, but it is the fact. Black people have lost ground. His most loyal constituency lost ground in every single leading economic indicator category. When he's out of office, we've got to come to Jesus meeting. And we got to talk about whether or not the price, to quote James Baldwin, was the price of the ticket too high? Was symbolism was symbolism enough, or did we really need some substance? And did we make any demands? And when Martin King came to terms with the fact that black folk had lost ground in every economic category, and that on race, you got a president who feels boxed in and can't say nothing about it, what's the point of having a black president that you celebrate as the first black president if he can't talk about race when it matters? See, during the campaign, when race mattered, and he had to, that Jeremiah Wright mess came up, he did a whole speech on race during the campaign. And all the good white people loved that race speech. Y'all said that was the best speech he'd given. Y'all, everybody loved the race speech during the campaign. So you can give a race speech during the campaign when it suits your interest to win. But when Ferguson's on fire and now you think it might hurt your poll numbers, you don't want to talk about it. That's inconsistent for me. And Martin would have had something to say to him about racism and poverty and militarism. A long answer, but you asked me a big question.
It's a wonderful answer. Tavis, does America today have a Dr. King? And if so, who?
We have many Dr. Kings. Many, 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 many. And by that, I mean what I tried to suggest in my close, that there are a lot of truth tellers whose names we don't know. But there are truth tellers in big cities and small towns every day who are doing the righteous work, doing the heavy lifting of trying to get America to see what our future looks like. If we don't start to address the issues that are threatening our very existence, the environment and poverty and drones and immigration, et cetera, et cetera. There are people every day who have some king in them who are trying against all the odds to tell the truth. So there are a bunch of little kings running around trying again to tell the truth, and we do ourselves a great disservice, Judge, if we ignore them.
From your perspective and MLK's likely perspective, how to best combat voter suppression?
This is one of the most depressing things for me, because we have come up with a problem chasing a solution. I mean, there is no problem with voting as the GOP Republicans would have us believe, voter fraud. They've made this up in an effort to suppress the rights of people of color to vote. All these laws drive, ID and this, and there's a litany of these things. And this is a very, you know, Hillary got in trouble years ago calling it a vast right-wing conspiracy, but that's what this is, a vast right-wing conspiracy to deny a whole segment of our population the right to vote. And so I think Dr. King would be most troubled by the fact that the battles that he thought we had won back in the day have come back with a vengeance. And that just underscores how you have to always remain diligent. You got to remain vigilant about the work. As we all know, freedom ain't free. We have to work at this every single day. And I think King would be just flabbergasted and dumbfounded that this fight that he thought they had won 50 years ago is back now, and we're fighting the same fight all over again. That would be depressing. The way to fix it, which I'm not holding my breath about, the way to fix it is Congress. But since Congress can't agree on nothing and get nothing done, I suspect this is not going to happen anytime soon. But on voter suppression, Congress needs to do the work. They need to put some more teeth in the law. And the Supreme Court, in the last year, took some of the teeth out of the Voting Rights Act. Big mistake. Congress can fix that if they have the will to fix it. They can fix voter suppression. They can fix the damage done to the Voting Rights Act. They can fix campaign finance reform. You know, they can fix that result of Citizens United. There are a lot of things that could be done if Congress had the will to do it, and voter suppression is one of them. But don't hold your breath on that. So the fight continues. The struggle continues.
Who speaks for the needs of today's African-American population?
The wrong people. I am not going to call names because I don't need to. But I will say this, that what is troubling for me is that too many black leaders, when defending their relationship and their friendship with the president, always want to cite the fact that Dr. King went to the White House for meetings all the time. They said Dr. King was the ultimate outsider. He was an agitator. He was. And then they try to suggest that Dr. King became an insider and went to the White House and had meetings, et cetera, et cetera. So they use Dr. King as a sort of cover for why they run him back and forth to the White House every other day. And I always want to tell them, and they know this, but they need to be reminded that the difference is that when Dr. King went to see Lyndon Johnson, he didn't come out pushing the Johnson talking points. Y'all niggas go see Obama, and you come out spewing the Obama talking points. That's not black leadership. That's black accommodationism. You know, that's not leadership. You have to go in and speak truth to power and push, as I said earlier, the president to do more about the data that's suggesting that black people are losing ground in every single leading economic indicator category. So it's not just about going to meet the president and hanging out. It's about telling the president what he needs to hear. And that sometimes means uncomfortable, inconvenient truths. I mean, I'm not the first person to say this. Part of the problem that Barack Obama has as president is he's gotten so insular with that group. I mean, everybody acknowledges this. He listens to that same core, tight-knit group of people. This is the biggest critique of him in Washington, that he doesn't get outside of that little circle of his friends and hear other perspective and get other points of views. And so you got a handful of Negro leaders who, you know, are the go-to people, and they come out spinning the Obama talking points. I mean, for example, I'm back to the war question right quick. This troubles me. How is it that black people in particular, since I'm in the Bay Area, progressives writ large, how is it that we have become this silent on the war question? How is that possible? We become silent, and in some ways, not just even silent, but supportive and deferential. Just because Obama's a Democrat, just because he's black, we become silent and deferential on the war question. Dr. King could not, were he here, understand that. You still have to speak those truths when people don't want to hear it. So that, you know, I have a simple definition of leadership. I'll close on this point. My definition of leadership is this. You can't lead people unless you love people. And you can't save people unless you serve people. That's my definition. You can't lead if you don't love. You can't save if you don't serve. So by that definition, King is the ultimate in leadership. Because it's about loving and serving people. Love, everybody's worthy, just because. Serving, King said anybody can be great because anybody can serve. All it takes is a heart full of grace and a soul that's generated by love. Leadership is about loving and serving people. Loving and serving people. And by that definition, we have leadership, not just in black America, but writ large, that's sorely lacking in America.
So we have time for one last question. I'm going to combine two.
Okay.
And they are as follows. As a millennial, I am not optimistic or hopeful for the future, especially with a Congress that does not represent the majority of Americans. Mm-hmm. What makes you hopeful? And this question, mm-hmm. you say, keep the faith at the end of each of your TV shows. In light of such terrible global atrocities, what advice do you have for keeping the faith?
Two great questions, and you brilliant to combine them. I can answer it this way. I am not an optimist. I am a prisoner of hope. Optimism suggests that there's a particular set of facts, circumstances, conditions, something you can see, feel, or touch that gives you reason to believe that things are going to get better. That's optimism. And the black experience in America, for me, has never been one of optimism. There's never been a time in black history where we could look at facts, circumstances, conditions that gave us reason to believe that things are going to get better for us. That's just not our condition. So I've never been an optimist. I get scared when I meet black people who say they're optimist. I'm like, okay, where you live? let me come hang out with you. So I am not an optimist. And now, beyond black folk, just to Americans and my fellow citizens in this room, you know, I'm not an optimist. And in America right now, there might not be a lot to be optimistic about. I saw a survey not long ago that suggested that for the first time ever, a slight majority of Americans think that our best days are behind us. It's hard to sustain your democracy. I mean, we're getting more and more every day, looking more and more like a plutocracy or an oligarchy, but it's hard to sustain what little democracy we have left when the majority of your citizens think the best days of your democracy are already behind you. So I'm not an optimist, and I understand why many Americans are not optimistic at this very moment. But I am a prisoner of hope. And not to proselytize, but one of my favorite Bible verses is this: faith is the substance of things hoped for, the evidence of things not seen. Even when you can't see it, King said all the time, even when you can't see, what faith allows you to do is to walk up a dark stairwell believing that the next step is going to be there for you. That's what faith and hope is. And so I'm not an optimist, but I'm a prisoner of hope. And I'm always hopeful that we can do better today than we did yesterday. And I believe that you can build a whole life on hope. I am Exhibit A, that you can build an entire life built on nothing but hope. I've had nothing else to build my life on but hope. Born a poor child, big family, navigated that 12-year-old beating. My whole life has been built on the hope that every day I wake up, I get another chance to get it right. And so again, not to proselytize, but to those who are looking for something to believe in, you might want to start with yourself, number one. But I say that I pray the same prayer every day, that Lord, when the evening comes and the night falls, I want to look back on this day and see something that I have done that I can submit to you that might not make me feel so ashamed. Now, whether you are Christian or atheist or agnostic or anything else, I think every one of us wants to believe that every day we get up, we get another chance to get it right. And whatever gift and skill and talent we have been endowed with, we get a chance every day to try to make a mark on the world. Every one of us, I believe, has to earn our space here. Somebody once said, our service and love to others is the price we pay for the space that we occupy. So loving and serving other people is how we earn our way in the world. We earn the right to be here. We have to do that. And so, again, when you can't be an optimist, you can always be hopeful. So don't ever lose hope, because when you lose hope, you've lost everything.
Our thanks to TV and radio host Tavis Smiley, author of Death of a King, the real story of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s final year. We also thank you, our audiences here and on radio, television, and the internet. I'm Judge Ladaris Cordell, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you are in the know, is adjourned.